Liv, it's very nice to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. And so you are a learning specialist, is that?
Yeah, that's my job title. Doesn't fully capture who I am. Just the people who do learning support in the library, that's our umbrella title. But my I would consider my actual profession as like a writing expert or writing teacher.
Mm.
And my job is to... I guess, recruit, hire, and train about 30 grad students every year, sometimes undergrads, to deliver tutoring and workshops for across the disciplines. So they come from all different colleges and disciplines, and I hire them to, teach other students. So I'm kind of training the trainers, but then I do some of the teaching of writing and tutoring of writing myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also work as a sessional. So for years, I taught in the English department, just first year classes, and but I've also had experience teaching for like business, government. I was an editor, so I've got outside university writing and communication instruction experience, and then I also have started teaching RCM 200, which is engineering professional communication. So I have students from kinesiology, engineering, and agriculture. And so I've taught that only twice now, but it's super interesting. It's really fun trying something new and helping students with communication, public speaking, and written communication for specific purposes outside of university.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's really, really energizing. It's fun. Yeah. Yeah. So that's like, so teaching, I guess, is why I'm here, and teaching writing is kind of like what I feel like is who I am. So as a job,
Did you always feel like that, like growing up and?
I always really liked writing when I was a kid, more into creative writing. I feel like as you get out of high school and your emotions simmer down and you start just cranking out academic papers, you lose that part of your brain, like the creative lateral thinking, creative writing brain. And so if I try to go back to it, it feels, doesn't feel, I feel like I'm not as creative. And I've become more logical or structured in the way that I write. But I've always really enjoyed writing. I thought I wanted to be an artist, and then I thought, well, I'm not gonna make any money, so I'll be an art teacher. But I've always thought about teaching, so that's always I'm from a big family, and we all went into different professions, but we're all teachers in some way. So my sister went into occupational therapy, now she teaches that, and my other sister went into she was a high school teacher, and she did drama. And now she teaches creativity at a business school. And like, and then I've got a brother who was a personal trainer. So he went into athletics. And so we all we must have a very bossy, like to be in control kind of group of people.
That's
but
funny.
We really like connecting with people and teaching. So, yeah.
Were your parents like that too? Or was it just kind of completely random for all of you guys?
It's on both sides, yeah. And my dad was a professor at the University of Saskatchewan. So I feel really lucky to have grown up with that. And I think when I started working at the Writing Center in grad school was the first time that I realized helping other students, like, I take for granted that I feel at home here and that I know what I'm doing. And I don't know why it hadn't occurred to me before, but it becomes more vivid when you're helping students one-on-one. And so otherwise it's just kind of theoretical, but when you meet, it's like, I am going to teach you the ropes here, because you do not have to be intimidated by that. You do. You can ask for that. Yes, you can do that. So I just became very excited about helping other students. And I always saw my dad do that too. Like, he was a prof in the 70s and when I was a kid, and he would take us to class with him. Like, it was a bit more of like hippie 70s prof. They used to smoke in class and so he'd bring us to class. He'd welcome his students to bring their kids to class. He'd a baby crying, he'd pick it up and keep teaching. He taught English. And so that seemed like normal to me, but it wasn't really normal. So I'm very grateful for that. And we still have a really good relationship. When I taught first year English last term, it was a section of reading poetry. And my dad, that was his area. It was Irish, modern Irish poetry. And so he's elderly now, but like sharp as ever. Like, he's brilliant. And so we just had weekly phone conversations where he helped me to explicate a poem and think of ways to teach it, because I didn't want to teach the same stuff I was teaching before. I always make a lot of work for myself, and because I want to be excited when I get up in front of students, I want to communicate my discovery and excitement of something as well, not just say, you know, crank out and like you feel like you're acting otherwise. So
this is a good way to put it.
Yeah. So I made a lot of work for myself, but it was really nice to have that weekly conversation with my dad. And yeah, so that was really valuable to me. Yeah, well. Yeah, I'm really happy that I did that. I was talking to you before this about how the marking just about killed me, because classes are so big now. Like, I had 50 students, and I think the last time I taught English it was in the 40s, and that felt pretty tough, but it just keeps kind of creeping up. And yeah, so we'll talk about first year students maybe at some point. My feelings about that, because yeah, I love first year students. Like, that's my favorite. So I get pretty frustrated with the institution in terms of how they welcome students to the academy.
Right, I was just putting them through.
Yeah,
that's totally fair. I cannot. I could attest to that. Sorry, I've got a stupid question. What is, you said explicate?
Oh yeah, explicating. So, like, my dad was, you know, educated in the 50s, so it's like formalist approach to reading and explaining poetry. So it's quite technical. Anybody could use that word if they're analyzing a poem.
Oh, okay.
But it's almost like he always showed me this showed his students like a picture of a bird that was diagrammed. So this is the wing, this is the, you know, all of the different parts of a bird. And he said, you know, the this bird isn't being harmed in any way. Like, you know, when we say we explicate a poem or we pull it to pieces or we ruin the enjoyment of it, he's like, it's quite the opposite. When we love something, we want to learn more about it. So like, how is it made? You know, that's really, Wow. And so I took that to the way that I teach writing. My engineering students, I thought, how can I transfer that to an excitement about like how to craft an email? So so what I was thinking about was like an engine. Like, say if you're really into cars, you're not interested in how they get you from A to B. I love it works, right? Like, I drove here today, I wasn't thinking about the car and my husband cares. I don't care. It got me here.
Yeah.
But if you love cars, you want to know how it got you there. You want to know everything about it. You want to lift the hood. You want to understand it. So it's kind of like that with language and English professors. That's what we're good at. And so if we move over to look at any kind of writing or any kind of language, we're really interested in, like, why does that not work? Or why does that work? How do people communicate differently in professional communication versus texting their mom versus writing and all, like, there's just so many different ways to communicate, and all of those complexities and how things are structured and made, and how everything hangs together is interesting. Like, even bad writing is really interesting to me because it's like, why is it so bad?
Yeah.
Like, okay, like, what makes it bad? Like, sometimes it can be hilariously bad, you know? So I just get enjoyment out of reading anything. Oh. I always tell my students, read everything. Like, yeah, like, bad, good, read it all.
That's really cool, actually. Yeah, I never thought about that, because I'm probably not as fascinated by it to the degree that you are, but I've actually talked with my friends about stuff like that, where, like, I get, like, obsessed over, like, if I'm saying a phrase over and over again, or I'm saying, using a word in my sentences a lot, and then all of a sudden I realize that I only know how to use it, but I don't actually know what the word means. I get, like, really obsessed about trying to figure out, like, okay, where did that word come from? Like, why am I saying it?
What
is the actual meaning about it? And how can I put it into my sentences better? Yeah. I'm such a nerd about it in just, like, my everyday life.
Yeah, so I think that's really human. And English is, I mean, we live in a really multicultural society where all kinds of Englishes, like, blend into how we speak. And so people have, like, the way my daughter, who's 19, speaks to her friends is like, there's some unfamiliarity to me. There's words that, and I kind of delight in that. Like, I'm like, that's not the proper. But yeah, that curiosity about, oh, why do we use that word it's actually fun reading the dictionary. Like,
Yeah.
Especially the one where the OED complete Oxford English Dictionary, where you can look at like the whole history of the word and like the many different ways it's been used, and all the different, like for example, if you looked up the word pitch in the dictionary, you'd have pages of all the different forms of pitch and like where it came from, like pitching and baseball, pitch black, all that, you know, adjective verb noun. So yeah, so language is, I mean, yeah, it's a bit of a rabbit hole. So yeah, I keep that nerdy instinct. It's it brings a lot of joy and it helps you be precise too.
Yeah.
And I find when you have language and you have vocabulary and you're able to say what it is, you what exactly want to say, like you have power, right? Mm-hmm. You are able to express yourself in ways that you're saying, you're really saying what you mean, especially in writing where you don't have nonverbal cues. Like it's just on paper. It's quite artificial. When we're talking to each other, I'm using, people listening won't see my gesturing or my facial expressions. They may not know what I look like. Mm-hmm. It's like if you ever listen to the radio and then you see the announcer, you're like, that's not what I.
Yeah, exactly.
So a lot is missed in nonverbal, you know, facial expression, tone of voice, all of that stuff on the page. All you have are the the words in particular arrangements. So you kind of have to, I guess, make up for the fact that you don't have the nonverbal, and that those nonverbal cues make us so human and so understood. And we can be really misinterpreted or misinterpret other people.
Yeah.
Tone, you know, you might think, are they angry? Like, you know, if I send my daughter a text and it's 1K, she's like, are you mad? I'm like, no, she's like, it's got to be KK. And I'm like, okay.
That's funny.
Whatever.
My mom is the same way.
Yeah.
No, so. it's fascinating. It's just, it's something really cool too about trying to fix errors and stuff too. Like when you see writing that's bad or just not even, it's not bad, but it's just not as clear.
Yeah.
You get to go through it and like figure out like, okay, like why does this paragraph not actually say what I want it to say? I really enjoyed doing that too. Like I helped my girlfriend out with some of her essays and she's, thankfully she actually appreciates the help cause I'm not a very good teacher, but it's fun to like go through it with her and, just point out things like I know what you're saying here intuitively, but you do need to be more clear. Like why is it said this way and why can't it be said?
I think that's the beauty of, like peer tutoring or having, I mean, all students since the beginning of time have helped each other with their writing. And the writing center that I run that just kind of formalizes it and those students get training, but they all have in common that they really enjoy, like I very much go on interpersonal skills. That's really important to me, more so than grades, right? So good writing, interpersonal skills, and weirdly, like if they've done poorly in 1 year of school or they've, especially first year, they make great tutors because they're more compassionate.
Right.
Yeah, but having a second reader, like, you don't have to be a good writer or know anything about grammar. You just have to be somebody trying to understand. So I help to run the undergraduate research journal. And a big part of that is students will say, submit a paper to a professor, get 90 something, prof, submit that to the journal for publication. So they submit it to us and there's a shift because now it's not just, the audience isn't just your professor, an expert, it's the world.
Right.
And so translating it now to plainer language, making it, explaining concepts before you start blending them together, all of that, that act of translation for a wider audience, the students who run the journal do a brilliant job because they are, you know, you'll have an English major looking at a philosophy paper and just like, you know, these are the places where it didn't make sense. So then they have a conversation with the editors by email, and then of course we have the faculty reviewers who help with that as well. So I think there's kind of a magic in the, like, say amateur reader or the ordinary human being reader, educated but knowing nothing about that discipline, and combined with, you know, faculty expertise. So you have a philosophy professor and then you have the non-philosophy major looking at this, and you can have like kind of really interesting combinations. So yeah, I love student run journals in that way. I don't think you get that with other publications. So like for example, if you were the editor or the editorial board of the Canadian Philosophical Review. That's all philosophers and judging other, you know, and then it goes to print. And of course they're thinking about wide audiences, but it's very much like a conversation between experts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you have people who are outside readers, that's so powerful and so important. So I'm a big champion of undergraduate publishing, and yeah. So that is really interesting to me. And there was something else I was going to say about that, but I can't remember.
Yeah, it's I imagine you get to watch people's writing skills just develop at like exponential rates.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah. You see, sort of see like, and then like there's like a threshold moment of just like bing, oh, and then there's like one skill that makes a massive difference, right? Yeah. It's really fun to watch. I hadn't had one of those myself for a long time, and I had it a couple of years ago working with my former colleague Heather McWinney, and I learned a concept from her that I for some reason had never come upon in my professional life as a writing expert. Like, who am I guess I'm not. And that one revision tactic just made a huge difference in my writing, like huge. So yeah, you're always improving, and but where you have those big surges in skill, it's very satisfying.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
What was the revision
it's
tactic?
Called the old new information contract. So look it up. It's amazing.
Okay.
So off, like we're kind of taught don't repeat yourself.
Sorry, old new
information contract. So it's sometimes called different things or variations of that, but the words old and new are in there. And so we're always taught like avoid repetition. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's good repetition and there's bad repetition. So bad repetition is where we're just spinning our wheels and saying the same thing over and over. It's fine to say things in other words, to re-explain, to help people come at it in different ways. But we know when we're not making progress and we're just kind of BSing and like repeating.
For sure.
Yeah. So, but good repetition is where you use the same language that you set out in your introductory paragraph, for example, throughout the paper. Don't change your terminology to keep the language fresh. That's the reader's through line. Like, they need to be able to follow that language. It's okay to repeat that. But this type of repetition that uses the old new information contract is where you look at the beginnings and ends of sentences. So the beginning of a sentence is considered new information and the end of the sentence is old information. And so you want to make it so that you have kind of chain link those in a chain using repetition.
Right, yeah.
And if I had my slides or an example, I'm trying to think of one. But you repeat information from sort of toward the end of the last sentence or a concept, you rename it at the beginning of the next sentence to be like, we just talked about that, now we're talking about this.
That's cool.
So you're not always like new sentence, new, apparently a new topic, but it's not. Mm-hmm. But the reader doesn't know that. They're suddenly like, why are we talking about garden lime? We were just talking about, at the end of the sentence, now I understand it's a type of fertilizer, you know. So making those kind of weaving the sentences together in that way.
Yeah.
And you don't have to be, you don't have to do that with every single sentence, but it can just be a really powerful change in terms of flow and clarity for your reader. And it helps me to stay on track too, because as you might have noticed in the interview, I'm like so when I'm writing, I go off the rails.
Yeah.
So it helps me to like keep the reader in mind and keep lockstep so that I'm staying organized as I write. So
it's almost like great. Showing like a new orientation of the same concept each time.
Yeah, kind of. Oh, it can be like that. Like, that would be more on like a large scale, like paragraph to paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
This would be just so simple. Like, you could say you're talking about, you're describing somebody's research in a sentence. The next sentence could say this research. Da, da, da. So instead of just this, it's this research. So that's a very tiny like way you could do it. Or you could be mentioning, garden lime at the end of this sentence as a fertilizer, so writing in agriculture. And you switch topics to saying something about soil. And then at the end of that sentence, you're talking about fertilizer or garden lime. Just flip that around so the garden lime is to get.
Right. Okay.
So changing the order of your sentences. So because the way that you're thinking of it, I mean, it's clear to you, maybe, but hopefully, but, you know, we've all had those experiences where it's like, I don't even know what I'm talking about, but
yeah.
Yeah. But just kind of, and we're very uncomfortable. Well, I was with repeating so soon, you know, I just said it. Why am I saying it again? It feels wrong. So it's a decision too of like, is it actually repetitive or is it helpful?
Yeah.
So yeah.
That's a tough one. I find that I struggle with that a lot. And, like I said, when I was helping my girlfriend out with her essays, that was one thing that, I found it the most difficult to explain just in the way I was thinking about it. I'm like, I know you're not supposed to repeat stuff a lot, but I need you to actually tell me this again here, just so that
say it out loud.
Yeah.
Is that what you were,
or just like rewrite it. I'm like, you need to bring this concept back in again somehow so that it's tied in.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
But it's tough because sometimes you feel like you're just rambling about the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, and you need another set of eyes. You know, we always think that, like, if I were to say, like, my sister, she was a drama teacher, the one I was talking about, who teaches in a business school now. She did an exercise where she's like, with students she was training in another job, and she said, okay, I want you to strike a pose right now, like drama theater sports time, strike a pose, student. And everybody went like this. And she's like, that's really interesting. Like, we think of isolation, students doing this isolated scholarly work. We're talking to each other. We're in class. We're in labs. We're not just doing this, right?
Yeah.
So I think that if I were to give students advice, it would be like, get out of your own head. Get help with your writing. Like, be a help seeker. Don't be shy about somebody giving you negative feedback on your writing. It's just something it's a draft. It's not what you're going to hand in.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people can, you know, I think part of, like, I've tried to think about this, and I'm sure there's been research out there, but I know that when I started university, I thought I was like, I really know my stuff. Like, I'm a good writer,
yeah,
you know, 60s right away. Yeah. And so you're humbled and you can sort of be like, oh, I'm a fraud. Or I hate that prof. They don't understand. You know, whatever your reaction, it'd be quite devastating if you think of yourself as somebody who can communicate and write. And we want to think of ourselves as good communicators because that's a really important human skill.
Yeah.
Like, there's shame if you're not a good communicator, or if you were struggled in school. And we're really can be quite cruel in high school and elementary school to kids who struggle to communicate. So we can kind of like compare ourselves or say things like, I'm not a good writer, and then just be like, haha, and we can laugh it off and feel better about it. Like, that's, oh, I'm so bad at math. Like, I say that about math, right? But that you just haven't learned it yet. Like, think about your baseline and think, okay, it's like, if you were to say, okay, try to make a crane with that piece of paper, and I'd be like, eh. And then you'd be like, okay, like, next time do this. And I'd be like, okay, now I can do it.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't expect yourself of just about any other skill to do it right off the hop, right? Like, if you're learning a sport, you don't just go in and clean. Like, you might have a lot of athletic, everybody's got like different natural talent, energy levels, whatever it is, access to equipment and mentorship, all of those things. So take that kind of support or advice, get out, don't be that student who just does this, ask. If somebody else did well, be like, how did you do that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, interesting. Like, I'm going to try to replicate that. Read something good. Oh, why is that good? Can I try to, maybe I'll use that type of transition when I write. So just be curiosity and be like nice to yourself. Like, this is something made. It's not you as a human being. It's just something you made. And it's a draft, or it's not that great, but you can make it good. It's fine. You know, like, kind of get the emotion out of it, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
I think
just like an athlete would be like, okay, I just have to practice that slightly differently, or I just have to angle things a little bit differently. Just, you know, learn, right?
Yeah, looking at like at why something didn't work, I think is a big, big one, like you said too. I find that,
Like, usually, like, you get, like, I know when I was a student, get my grade, I'd be like, you know, you're not thinking about, wow, how can I make that better? You're like,
exactly.
I don't want to forget that ever happened, and you don't want to think about it again, or I'm not going to be an English major anyway. I don't need this class. I'm going to be an engineer or whatever it is. So you kind of, it's a way of protecting your feelings, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, I don't care anyway, you know.
Yeah.
So, and which is fine. Maybe you don't care and it's fine. But if you want to if you want to become a better writer, you can. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, anybody can. So.
Well, I think discarding it like that is just, it's easy because you can pretend that it's outside of your control and then that it's not something, if it's not something you can fix and it's not something negative.
It's either the prof or this assignment was stupid. And sometimes they are stupid assignments, frankly. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of assignments come through. There's amazing assignments and you get the occasional one. You're like, what is this prof doing to the students there? We don't say anything. We can't. But it's like, but yeah, so if you don't really have respect for the project or the professor, if you don't think that you are going to need this skill, it doesn't have to be English class, it could be any class where you're communicating, then you're not going to read the feedback. You're not going to pick the paper up. If, you know, that's what we used to do, pick the paper up. You're not going to open it and read the comments, you know. You just want the grade and to make, have the whole experience be over with.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, and that's fine. But you do have a choice, and if you want to begin to improve things, looking at the feedback, sometimes feedback's not very helpful, so you have to seek it out. So, you know, the prof might have just scribbled a few comments, and then you could just be like, oh, can we talk about how I could improve this? Or you could go to the writing center and we can look at something that's been graded and help you to understand what happened. Yeah. Do some forensics with you. And that'll help you with your next paper.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think that, like you mentioned, that you have a choice is a big part. And I think a lot of people are the way I was in university. I didn't always feel like that, but it was because I was ignoring it. Like, I was choosing not to think I had a choice. And sometimes I look back on my classes and I just think, like, man, I really, really wish that I would have actually sat down and focused on just not even getting better at this topic, but just using that class or that subject or that assignment as a way to get better at just being a student. Mm-hmm. And so whenever I had a paper, I actually remember writing a paper and getting like a 76, and then our TA was like, we had another one, and then the TA said that this one, based on the comments that we got from the last one, this one should be better. And so I busted my ass on it, and I thought I'd written a much better paper, but I ended up getting like a 70, so I got a lower grade.
Yeah.
And I did exactly what we were talking about. I was like, whatever, I'm not an English major. And I should have went to the learning center, because the writing is one of those things that I actually enjoy doing now outside of school, and I wish I would have made that choice to get better at it and study why I was not doing as well as I thought.
Yeah. So. And if your prof's like, it sounds like if you had a TA, you were in a really big class.
Yeah.
So you maybe feel like you lack that access to the instructor, but I think like first year students in particular often don't realize or have the confidence to even consider that they can go to their prof and ask for some feedback. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as an instructor, it tends to be the students who are already getting A's that are like, can we just do a, you know, deep dive on my, like, why did I get a 90 instead of a 90?
Yeah.
You know, they're the ones who are coming to you, and everybody else, you're like, please talk to me. You know, you're always going to have professors who don't have time for that, or who are going through things, or who, you know, professors are really being piled, the work's really being piled on them. Or they just are really not into teaching, but most professors, they're happy that somebody's interested in, like, you're interested in talking about, like, what I do and how to be better at it. Like, that's exciting to them. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So sometimes it's just, I'm thinking of you back then as, you know, was it a first year class?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was it English or?
Yeah, I think 110 or 111.
Yeah.
Yeah. Literature and composition.
Yeah. So that's great. You have your grad students. It's almost like the writing center, but there's a power differential there. Like they grade, or the professor grades, and you know, if you go to a friend or the writing center or hire a tutor, whatever method you have, or talk to a family member to get help, you don't have that power differential. Like, we don't tell your prof that you came to us at the writing center. So you can maybe have a less loaded conversation where you feel like you don't feel like you have to please us, you know, or like, not that you should have to charm or please your instructor, but it's like, we're all sort of watching ourselves when we know that somebody's can grade us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, I think it's important to have those student support centers where students can, it's kind of like an in-between space.
Yeah. That makes perfect sense too. Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned, first year students and just like frustration with their
process,
I guess. Is that a lot of the kids that are coming into the Writing Center, and is that where you're seeing?
Yeah, we see a lot of first-year students. We see students for all the way from first year to people who are finishing their dissertation, all different disciplines. I'd say most of the people we see are from College of Arts and Science, because of our proximity. We're in Murray, but we also have tutoring at the Aboriginal Student Center, and we do pop-ups. So we did one at a pop-up writing center for the Indigenous Teacher Education Program in College of Education. And so we'll just bring like a backpack and some resources and some hand, like free pencils, and like sit down. And students are usually working on a project, in common project, and they just make progress, right? It's like a lab. So we see students from all different, but we have to do that outreach to make sure we're getting not just the students who, the keeners, like they tend to be the ones who are like help seekers, the students who are already doing well. It's, we're really trying to hit those students who got their first paper back in October, and like that's a really critical point. Your first term, your first midterms, your first papers, you know, that's pretty intense for a lot of people. Sometimes it's really high stakes, like for people who are first in family, like first in their family to go to university, who have kids, like 10% of students are caregivers. And that's not just grad students, like undergrads. So it's a different demographic than when I went to school. Most students work. University is much more expensive than it used to be when I went to school, or people older than me. So there's just like a real intensity around it. So the affordability of school, and now we've got post-pandemic inflation, climate anxiety, like your generation is confronted with a lot of pressures that I think older generations can be quite hard on you. And I think that we are maybe assuming that you're coming in with the same circumstances that we did. Like, you'll hear people in my parents' generation, or even my Gen X, whatever that is, say things like, you know, students these days are they're not resilient, or they've got all these anxiety problems, or they're lazy, or they don't have the skills, or they can't, you know, they have this real deficit understanding of a student coming into first year university. But they're thinking in terms of their own experiences of, you know, my tuition was not that high. I worked, but it wasn't like a lot because my tuition wasn't that high. I could manage a full course load. I don't think that's manageable for most students now unless they have money, you know? Yeah. So I think there's all these pressures, and then the students coming in now have been through pandemic high school. Like that's traumatized. That's terrible. Like there's real loss, like didn't have a grad, or experienced real mental health crises, or grief, or loneliness, like the isolation. So I think that we just need to be way more kind and way more compassionate. And being kind and compassionate doesn't mean we're letting people off easy, or we're accepting poor work. It just means putting more resources, university resources, into first year, I think is really important. Like if we could have a university that was not like 95% of other universities, where first year meant big classes, that would make a huge difference. So think about coming into your first year and your classes are 20, 25 students. It's going to be a profoundly different experience, just class size. And every higher admin would be like, too expensive. But think about like the ripple effects. Like, you're going to have alumni donors in a few years who had an amazing experience. They're going to give you their money. Like, I'm thinking like a capitalist here. You're going to have to put fewer resources into mental health supports. Like, it's pumping into... That's like downstream. You want to go upstream. You want to prevent rather than try to... You want mental health supports, and you want all of these things for students, but it would make a huge difference if you had smaller classes. If you're a student with a disability, a smaller classes really can be quite helpful. Because you know your prof. Having that connection with a faculty member, it's really confidence building, and really... I think one of the most important things that can happen in your first year is connecting with faculty. So yeah, access to mentors. The other thing that administrators get really concerned about is retention. So you probably heard that. Yeah. So it's basically like bums in seats. Like, we want these students to continue and complete their degree here. And a lot don't. So you have to look at, well, why, you know. And there are some targeted first year programming that can kind of, that has looked at particular student populations. And what are they doing? Small sections. Why can't we do that for all students? Is what I would, what I would argue. Yeah.
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 It's, yeah, it's so tough, right? I agree. I think smaller class sizes would, anecdotally, they were better for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I went to a lecture and there was like 300 other students in the class, like I just like, a lot of times I would just skip. I just wouldn't go. And I'd be like, yeah. I know this, that I'm not getting a personal connection with the professor,
mm-hmm.
and that I also felt bad for them too, because they've got kids like me sitting in there and sometimes falling asleep, because
mm-hmm.
it's so far removed from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would just go home and just try and get the notes online and just do it that way instead of going.
Yeah.
But when I had classes like, that were smaller class sizes, I was so much more engaged,
mm-hmm.
and they were more fun. The learning was better. You feel that personal connection with your professor a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But then there was also, I actually felt a little bit more of a, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not expectation, but like, I don't know what the word exactly I'm looking for is, but like, I felt more of a responsibility to be there because I knew the professor would recognize my face.
Yeah, if they know you.
Yeah. And so I felt worse if I didn't go, especially because mm-hmm. I had one professor, his name was Charles Smith, and he started, he started like not threatening us, but like getting choked because he took attendance with, like a short answer at the end of class. And when people would stop showing up, he would, I think he would like threaten to make the assignments harder or something like that. No. So I'm like,
he was pretty frustrated.
Yeah. But it was actually really cool to see that he cared, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I would go, and then like, he would,
was this a large class too?
That he would, it was probably larger, like it's probably 35 or 40 mm-hmm. students.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But it still wasn't, I didn't feel like it was that big, because mm-hmm. he tried to call on everybody. And he would like remember your answers from different mm-hmm. things and kind of try to remember what your stance might be on something. And
yeah.
But it was just so much fun because we're probably just at the maximum amount of students where he could actually try and keep everybody engaged. And,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and there's a tipping point for sure.
Yeah.
And it really depends on the discipline too. Like where you have humanities or social sciences classes quite often, well, any class where there's, the interactivity makes the learning so much richer, mm-hmm. Rather than just like a fire hose of information, go home, try to process it if you have time, you know. Yeah. But having that, using the class time, like you can take in all the information on your own and then come to class knowing that they see you and they know if you're coming or not. And you can have a dialogue, or you can do an activity, testing out what you've already learned, rather than going to class and just taking a whole bunch in and then doing a lab or an assignment on your own.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It's almost like, I think it's called flipped classroom, where professors will do, have you do kind of all the information you need that could be delivered during class time. They have you do that ahead of time. And then during class time, they're doing assignments with you or doing work with you.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. But anyway, that's that feeling of responsibility or expectation. Mm-hmm. The other thing is like you feel a bit more cared about.
Accountability was the word I was looking
Accountability. For. Accountability. Yeah. Yeah. Which is good. I mean, mm-hmm. yeah. The prof is going to be, they're going to have more resources. They're going to be happier and they'll have more resources to get in touch with you. So if I notice that one of my students is showing up, when I taught engineering communication last term, I had 22 students. It was like a dream. It was so lovely to have a class that small. And the minute one didn't come, like I knew their names within a week. I just emailed them like, is everything okay? Like, well, it wasn't, you know?
Yeah.
So you have the resources as an instructor to take the energy to do that. And otherwise I think you can get jaded as an instructor. If you have a big class, you start to get kind of angry. So you'd be like, you start to say things like, wow, this term's group of students, or, you know, you hear profs talking like, wow, they're really not showing up. Like last term, the attendance was really bad. Mm-hmm. We're like, well, it's first pandemic return to class. I don't know. I think just students have been through a lot in high school. Like I'm talking about first year students. And they've also been able to have that flexibility of doing their work at home or at school. And so the concept of showing up in attendance is vaguely feels optional. And, you know, and when you get those bad marks back in October, maybe because of a skills gap, because of pandemic high school, you didn't get the skills you need.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of give up. Like, why would you show up, right? So if you have a really big class, you're going to just dissolve and into the distance, and the university won't even follow up with you. Really. Yeah. Nobody cares, honestly. I know one student who had to drop out. A student I know had to drop out last term because of an illness that had been getting worse over the term.
Mm.
And so he had probably 60% of a history degree, and he, because of his illness, he's just only doing two classes. He's been working on it for a long time, getting good grades. Like he's an honors level mm-hmm. student, but he just wants to do it 3 years. So, and so he had to get retroactive withdrawal because it went right up till he thought he could do finals and he couldn't. So term two, he got retroactive withdrawal. And so that would have been May he found out that he got it. And then nobody's saying, like, are you okay? Are you coming back?
Mm-hmm.
He's in, I won't say the major, but the department is not, you know, following. Or did I already say the major? I can't remember.
No.
Nobody in the department cares. Yeah. Like, so they've lost bums in seats. There goes tuition. Like, why would he come back? Like, I think he will, but it's, you know, what he's been through is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And does the institution seem to care? No. So, yeah. And I don't want this to be about slamming the University of Saskatchewan. I think it's a great university. It's just a structural, it's something that's happening at all universities, just about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a trend of defunding of education. So government's giving less money to universities. So universities having to rely on research money and fundraising. And the whole enterprise of teaching and learning kind of gets forgotten unless it's about tuition. So mm-hmm. how do we keep students here? How do we raise tuition they raise it every year. So some of that is not the evil university. Some of that is governmental, societal, not thinking that university is important or that we're doing anything worthwhile. And what are they studying in the ivory tower? You know, feeling like they don't want their tax money going to universities. So that has an impact on tuition. And then at the same time, we're inviting a much more diverse group of students into universities than we ever did. So we've got a lot more international students, a lot more students from first in family, different, more indigenous students. We've got many more students with disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of changing how we do teaching and learning and how we structure, like I fix on class size, but there are other things. We are making the classes bigger and kind of sprinkling mental health support on you. Like it's, yeah, to me, I feel like I have the magic answer in a small class sizes and lowering tuition. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think, I don't think you're wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that the other thing that I've noticed just as not as an instructor, but in my role, at the learning specialist role or writing center coordinator, working with student volunteers. So for the undergraduate research journal, we hire an editor in chief who's a grad student, but all the undergrads are volunteers. And so what I started noticing pattern over time, like we started in 2013 or 14, I'm thinking these students come from privilege. So students who get involved with the journal have the time to, they don't have to work.
Yeah.
Right? They have resources. And so if they do that volunteer experience, that leads to me saying, oh, that student is amazing, you should hire them over here, they get a job, or a letter of reference for medicine, or that volunteer snowballs into a research job, or so it has this kind of effect. I've seen it, you know. And then you have students who start off volunteering and they fall off because they just, their responsibilities are too many.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea of volunteering, like, I think there needs to be, I'm right now trying to write up a case with a librarian for a bursary for those students. So we won't know their identity if they can't afford it. It just goes through awards and they can just apply for a bursary to be a volunteer with the undergraduate research journal, and the bursary would cover the cost of like maybe like weekly groceries, or like it would just offset.
And then nobody knows who's getting it.
Nobody would know who's getting it.
Oh, okay.
Just student awards. So it would all be administered through awards. So we're trying to get the library to give money for that. Mm. So that's really exciting. But I think that, yeah, we're like, students have to do a lot more to get a job now. Like, they got to volunteer. They have to build an orphanage. Like, whatever. Like, they've got to be these amazing people, especially in really competitive programs. Mm. Some people can't afford to volunteer.
Yeah.
You know, they're working. They got to work.
Yeah, it makes such a big difference. I think people forget that sometimes, because I definitely did. I was pretty naive about that. Like, when I was younger, didn't understand why, like, some people weren't putting in the effort that other people could have, and when they knew they were just as intelligent or this, that, or the other thing. And so I try to look at my situation to open my eyes up a little bit more, and because I was very lucky that my dad could cover all of my costs mm-hmm. going through school.
Yeah.
And so, but in the midst of it, it didn't feel like, I was like, well, I'm still paying for the things I want. Like, I still have a job. So I'm still buying things and mm-hmm. doing this and that. Like, I'm working.
Mm-hmm.
So it just didn't make sense to me all the time why it was so much harder for other people. But then I wasn't really thinking about the fact that just because, I'm not paying for my tuition or for my books or for these other things doesn't mean that that's not a monetary gain to me.
Right,
it just hasn't passed through my pocket.
Right.
And
right,
so
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
But that, like you said, with that, when you have that, you have all this other time to do this volunteer work and that,
yeah.
As to your resume. And, mm-hmm. and so
yeah,
I try to keep my eyes open to it a little bit more so I can be a little bit more open-minded now. But
yeah. And I think some students are just maybe not ready and they are genuinely slacking off and could be doing better. Like,
yeah.
You know, it's like, come on, what are you doing? You're in university, take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really interesting. Like, I hear people in my generation, like, I paid for my own university. My parents didn't. But I got scholarships, but like, I grew up with a university family. So I did poorly my first essay. My dad helped. Like,
mm-hmm.
so I was able, and then I got scholarships. So I paid my way, but it was through that kind of the experiences that I was lucky to have growing up. But then also, like, my husband, he paid for his university. He worked at, he was from a more, like, working class family.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked at the dairy and did, like, heavy lifting stuff and, like, worked nights and went to school. So I saw that when we were together in university. We've been together, it's our 25th anniversary this week.
Congratulations.
We were together, we met in like 1991. So we went through university together and I was able to see his experience.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's like kind of like, there's pride from that. Like, I put myself through university.
Yeah.
And so you hear people who've done that in my generation, for example, like, well, I worked and went to school and I put myself through, and I think it's good for you to do that. Otherwise you take for granted that you're in school, and which you can, if you have wealth, you could be like, I'm going to dabble and then I'm going to go to Europe. And then, you know, like, you cannot realize that it's very high stakes for other people. So I think we can kind of be like, well, I did it, so you can do it. Or I struggled, so you can struggle.
Yeah.
But it's a whole different struggle now than it was when we were, like, when my husband was working at the dairy, he made enough money for tuition, for rent, like, he could cover everything.
Mm-hmm.
You can't now. Like, inflation, rent is crazy. There's not much hope of being able to buy a home for most people of Gen Z or millennials. It's just a different gas. Like, everything's different now.
Yeah.
So when you hear somebody, and when I hear somebody from my generation say, like, well, I did it, it's like, okay, consider this. Like, this is what you made. This is what tuition was. This is how much gas costs. This is how much this, and they're like, and now, okay, do the math for somebody now. Oh, you know, it's a very different story. Yeah. It's not the same. No. Like, it'd be really hard to do a full load.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
Yeah, housing costs and tuition have, especially in Canada. I think in Canada, Canadians spend more money on their homes than I think.
It's really
everybody else on the planet, I think, actually. I think it's the most expensive here.
Yeah, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, like a lot of the Commonwealth countries, somebody was saying to me the other day, are
and,
expensive,
Yeah. It's interesting, too, because I think Canadians are so much more willing to be house poor or just to just eat the mortgage increases, too.
Yeah.
And so then it just keeps the prices elevated for homes. And then, like you said, it makes it
hard for students. Yeah, they always say the bubble's going to burst and it's not.
Yeah.
I think it's like one of those evergreen, like it's always a good investment to buy property kind of thing. It's not always true, but it has that security.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, people definitely want to hold on to it. It's not something you want to give up, right?
So. Yeah, yeah.
But it's tough because then you look at this and it's just, it keeps getting more expensive to house yourself. And so.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Or even find a place. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My sister works at UBC and she was saying they had offered somebody a job as a dean. I think it was dean or director, like a high paying job.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all down to the final. Yeah. They took the offer and then they reneged because they couldn't find anywhere affordable to live in Vancouver.
Yeah.
Like there's nowhere to live.
It's insane, right?
They're like, we can't. No, we're gonna stay in the States.
Yeah,
yeah. It's quite the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
We're no longer talking about education, but I think these things are all connected.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I just feel like it's very important for me to, go to bat for students when I'm talking to try to be as persuasive as possible when I talk to colleagues or administrators or instructors who are weary and may, like, you hear them complain about students and I feel their frustration because of faculty pressures as well.
Mm-hmm.
They're under, you know, there's some profs who are coasting out tenure and doing nothing, but most profs are under, they do a lot of work, like they work a lot of hours, mm-hmm. and a lot of it's focused on research, so they can become resentful of students who aren't performing, just forgetting, you know. So I try to advocate as much as I can. And the other thing I really try to do and teach my tutors to do is to help the students put it in perspective, their experience in the system, and navigate the system.
Mm-hmm.
So I had an experience this year has been tough. Like, we went through more Kleenex in the writing center than we ever, like,
mm-hmm.
students were struggling this year, like mental health. And so we'd get them like, here's my paper, and like, because we don't have that power differential, and because you're sitting with someone and they start talking about your frustrations, with like, people cry. So anyway, I was helping one student who was struggling really, like, panic. She had her paper due the next day. She had been working really, really hard on it. And she didn't, I said, have you asked for an extension? I can't. So I helped her to write a letter to an email, like a properly formatted kind of persuasive email, not overly like, oh, my life, you know, just like simple, like, these are the reasons. Here's what I propose. Here's what I've done. All the information a prof needs to make a decision that you are a credible human being who, you don't have to give your life story to ask for an extension. Because she, some of her reasons were due to some traumatic things happening in her life. Mm. And so it was, I'm like, you don't have to tell your life story to get an extension. Like, in fact, it's probably not that helpful to do that. I said, all you need to do is show, A, you've done some work so far, and B, here's what you propose.
Mm.
And show understanding of the prof's position, that I understand this is a busy time, and I'm really sorry for inconveniencing, like, so how to write a persuasive request for an extension. We wrote that email together instead of working on her paper.
Yes, yeah.
And she got an extension. So, but she didn't know she could do that. So it's like an advocacy job as well. So you're teaching the student how to, like, in terms of writing, how to navigate the system. Another one might be a professor who doesn't want their students using they as a singular pronoun. So we've got this kind of real culture war over pronouns, mm-hmm. like using they instead of he or she is a singular pronoun, because it's, and so some profs don't want that, even though the APA guide is now saying, yeah, use a gender neutral, the not gender neutral, but instead of he, him, use they as singular. Oh, well, yeah. Yeah. So that, like, the world is changing, but some people aren't. And so talking to students in the writing center, they're like, well, my prof doesn't want me to do that. And you can be like, okay, here's what the APA guides, if you want, this is how you talk to your prof about it. If mm-hmm. you want to insist on, like, if you want to make that argument to them, if you want to pick that battle, here's how you can do it. So we're not, like, against the professors. Like, these are just examples of maybe students not understanding what power they have,
yeah.
or how to get what they need to succeed. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'd never thought about that kind of help being offered to students too, because, like, yeah, that's really interesting. Because that's always been, I shouldn't say always, but that by the time I was in university, those kind of skills were very natural to me. Mm-hmm. My parents, as soon as I was old enough to contact anybody on my own behalf, my parents would make me do it.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
it was just like...
You're comfortable.
Yeah.
Talking to people in authority.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like booking appointments, calling the doctor, talking to my teachers, discussing grades. As soon as I could, my parents wanted me doing it. So by the time I got to university, mm-hmm. if I needed an extension or something like that, it was... It made the most sense to me to be like, explain my case and just like, this is yeah. why I want an extension, or this is why this won't be in on this time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I'd never thought about it not being natural for anybody else.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Or, I mean, they're coming in, they just don't understand, like, they don't come from a, maybe it's because they don't come from a family where university is, anybody's gone to university.
Mm-hmm.
So it's amazing how much you pick up if you have somebody in your family who has. Like, you just absorb whether you even care or not. It's just in the air, you're talking, you yeah. even complain about a class, whatever. You learn a lot about what you can do and what you can't do. And some people learn that from friends. Like, they start university with a group of friends who know the ropes, and they get their information from peers or mm-hmm. siblings or, you know. So, yeah. but yeah, not everybody. It's a lot of people come in just, like, terrified. Like, a lot of people. Hmm. Yeah, and it's so fulfilling, like, demystifying it.
Yeah,
like,
I bet.
You can totally roll into that room and do that. Like, what are you talking about? Or, yeah, you can. Oh yeah, you can do that. You know.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah, you have more powers. Or it's, to me, it's like, I did like a teaching philosophy recently, and I'd never done it. I find them kind of cheesy, but it was a really good experience.
Yeah.
But it was like, I want. My idea is that, when a student comes to university, I assume that they belong there. I don't think that they have to work to prove they belong there. They belong there. And so if you start with that assumption that they belong there, there's mutual respect. Mm-hmm. And then teaching and learning happens. So that's kind of where that's what I figured out was part of my philosophy was, it's just a shift in kind of this performance model, like you come here, you perform, you compete, and more of community, like you come here, welcome. Okay, who are you? Sometimes, like, the changing student population tells us that we need to change, not them. They're not coming in with a set of, like, we often talk about certain student populations coming in with deficits, like, what's wrong with this group? Oh, international students. Here's everything that's struggling. Here's everything that's wrong.
Mm.
Okay, how lucky are we to have them here? Like,
yeah.
they make us a really good place. Like, it's diverse, it's interesting. They bring in different perspectives. That's what a university is supposed to be.
Yeah.
We're supposed to be a place that's lively, where there's debate, where there's different ways of doing things, different ways of understanding the world. Like, we have this motto, be what the world needs. Like, so yeah. So sometimes people coming in teach you that you need to change, not that they are a set of problems to be solved, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. Like, I've learned some lessons, and I've made mistakes in terms of really, like, arrogant assumptions about student groups or particular students, and, like, I've been humbled, and you just learn over time, like, I have to keep changing too. Like, I have to learn from who's coming here, and I don't want to become that kind of old person who talks about the good old days. Like, I feel like it's, you know, young people are so important. Like, the children are our future. Like, I don't want to pull out a cliche, but, like...
It's true, though, I think, you know.
Yeah, you guys have the energy. Like, I'm getting tired.
It's, Yeah. I try to make a point. I'm not very good at it, but I try to make a point of... When somebody else is talking, I just shut up and just listen. Because you never know what's, you know, like...
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
And everybody's got a different perspective. And you don't know where you're wrong and where they're right or the opposite. And so.
Yeah. Yeah. Be curious. Like, we're in a university. Like, mm-hmm. you're supposed to be curious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't make assumptions. Gather evidence. So don't decide that you already know everything. It's really important. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So enjoy learning and enjoy change, I guess. And change is really hard for some people. And I get that. I'm the type of person who gets really bored really easily, and I like to go with the flow, and I like, you know, and for some people it can take longer and it's slower, and that's okay.
So, yeah, well, we're all different, right?
So, yeah.
Well.
So.
Well, that feels like a good spot to end it. Was there anything that we covered that, or didn't cover that you wanted to?
I don't think so. It was really nice talking with you.
It was very nice talking with you, too.
Yeah.
Do you want to let people know how they can find the Writing Center or get in contact with you if they want to?
Yeah, so if you're interested in getting involved with as a tutor or getting help from the Writing Center, it's at the Murray Library. And you can look up, just Google my name or go to the library homepage, and there's a link to the Writing Center where you can get information about workshops, resources. We have an artificial intelligence and writing guide. Ooh. Yeah, that's going to be very big deal this year.
Yeah.
It's going to be chaos. We've got links to how to get one-on-one tutoring. And then if you're interested in the Undergraduate Research Journal, if you are a grad student or an undergrad, you can just contact me directly. And the email address, writinghelp@usas.ca, goes just directly to me.
Okay.
And you can ask about, we're going to be doing recruiting, interviewing, and hiring for undergraduate research journal positions for the fall. So if you're interested in getting involved in the journal, get a hold of me. And I think, that's all my areas, I think.
Perfect. That was amazing. I learned a lot, and that was a great conversation. So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Of course. Nice way to end the week and go into the long weekend.
Exactly.